Chase Bodine is a Rhodes Scholar, recently spent a year in Venezuela working as a researcher and a writer, meeting people in all walks of Venezuelan life. He has co-authored with two Venezuelans, Gabriel Gonzalez and Wilma Bumbos, what must be the definitive book to date on recent developments in the Venezuelan Revolution. It is called Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers, just published by Thunder's Mouth Press. Welcome, Chase Bodine.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm glad we finally caught up with you. We've been trying to interview you for quite some time, and you have been traveling around the world. You have the book and the questions neatly broken into understandable categories. And the first one, under the politics of revolution, is appropriately, who is Hugo Chavez? So let's start with that and tell us who he is and how he came to be the president of Venezuela.
Well, it's obviously a key question to understanding the current political developments in Venezuela and indeed the region. Hugo Chavez comes from a very working class background, a rural background. He was born and raised in the plain state of Barinas. Both of his parents were school teachers, and he was raised primarily by his grandmother. He was one of, I think, seven or eight siblings, a very large family. And he had the dream, like many young Venezuelans, of going on to become a professional baseball player. He believed that the best way to accomplish that goal was to make a name for himself in Caracas. And to do that, he joined the military, went to the military academy as a way of getting a free ride to Caracas. He ended up playing baseball for the military academy's team, but never made a career out of it. Instead, he went on to become an officer to earn his master's degree in political science, I believe it was, from the Simón Bolívar University, and became very disillusioned with the policies of the governments running Venezuela. Venezuela, I should tell your listeners, had a very stable democratic system dating back to 1958, in which the two leading Venezuelan political parties, the AD and the COPEI parties, agreed with each other to share power, kind of like the Democrats and the Republicans in our country, to share power and essentially to prohibit and block other political groups and parties from having any meaningful representation in government. Well, that system, that pacted democratic system, was very stable, but it was also exclusionary and unrepresentative of a large section of Venezuelan society. And Chavez, like many Venezuelans, became disillusioned with this system. And in 1992, Chavez led a military coup. It failed. And in the aftermath of the coup, he was allowed to go on TV and tell the other people around the country who had been plotting the coup with him to step down and to avoid further bloodshed. Well, in that 60-second appearance on TV, then Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez became a national hero. He was seen as one of very few people who had been willing to stand up to this exclusionary democratic system, to take a risk and then take responsibility when his risk did not pay off. A little more context to explain why it is that he would have participated in a coup. In 1989, Venezuela found itself in the uncomfortable situation of having huge foreign debts, which it was unable to finance. In order to refinance its debt, the International Monetary Fund and other international financial institutions required that Venezuela's politicians, president then was Carlos Andrés Pérez, put in place a series of structural adjustment programs, known as neoliberal economic policies, to those of us on the left in the United States. And these policies involved reducing government expenditures on subsidies and on social services, increasing value-added taxes, opening the economy to cheap imports from other countries, and so on. Well, these policies had an immediate detrimental impact on the quality of life for the poor majority of Venezuelans. In 1989, the poverty rate, the extreme poverty rates, in other words, the percentage of people living on $2 a day or less, more than doubled, from 15% of the population up to over 30% of the population. Over the course of the month of February, these policies led to a widespread popular protest, what was known as the Caracazo, in which hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. The protests turned to rioting and looting, and the military was called in. The protests were put down with a hail of bullets. Well, over the next 3 years, right up until Chavez's attempted coup, There were over 12,000 protests across Venezuela, an average of 4.5 protests per day in a country of just 25 million people. Well, the government systematically failed to respond to those protests. Meanwhile, poverty continued to climb. President Chavez's coup was really a response to the failure of the government of Carlos Andres Perez to respond to rising poverty and to these popular protests. The following year, after Chavez was arrested, put in prison, Carlos Andres Perez, the president, was impeached on corruption charges. President Chavez and the other coup plotters were released, were pardoned by the interim government, and he immediately began an election campaign, which ultimately led to his election in a vote carried out in 1998. So that's the short version.
Now, it's interesting how the U.S. continues to describe Chavez and Venezuela as a rogue state, but it's clear that his image has inspired movements entirely across the entire Latin America, and even at one point Colombia has shown a bit of rebelliousness to the United States, But we see that Venezuela has become like a class war, with the poor supporting Chavez and the rich and the main big media people supporting or opposing him and taking a pro-U.S. position. What has Chavez actually done for the poor since he has been the president?
Well, it's a really important question. You know, a lot of people blame President Chavez for the polarization, the political polarization that exists today in Venezuela, saying he's exacerbated these class tensions and so on and so forth. Well, with an analysis which really misses the point, the point, I think, being the deep inequalities that have existed well before Chavez was elected, the inequalities which he's attempting to remedy. So what has he done for the poor people in Venezuela? Well, there's a wide range of programs. First, let me give you a few statistics, and then we'll talk more concretely about some of the social programs in place. The Economist, a mainstream weekly news magazine, which is constantly critical of the Chavez administration, ran an article about 2 weeks ago in which they were, not surprisingly, critical of the Chavez administration's attempts to alleviate poverty. Despite their criticisms, they ran the following, I think, quite impressive statistics. According to this article in The Economist, the economy in Venezuela has grown by over 28% over the last 2 years, more than any other country in Latin America. In addition to that, one wonders, obviously, well, how does that economic growth impact poor people? Are they benefiting from it? Again, according to the same Economist article, the poorest class of Venezuelan citizens saw their income increase over the same time period, 2 years, by over 43%. Their consumption levels have more than doubled. So, yes, you do see a huge, very, very concrete impact and benefit for poor Venezuelans, a dramatic increase in their income levels, dramatic increase in their consumption levels, really unprecedented in terms of poverty alleviation efforts, even in wealthy countries like the United States, to have this kind of a rapid gain for the poorer sectors of society. Now, how has that been accomplished? What are the kinds of mechanisms? And I think it's also important to recognize that the real gains, I think the most profound, significant gains that poor Venezuelans have achieved in the Chavez era are not really represented by these kinds of statistics. They're not represented by income changes. They're a change that has to do with something much more profound, which is their stake in a democratic process. Poor people in Venezuela now have a role to play in managing their government, in overseeing their elected officials. Everything from city councilmen all the way up to the president. And the sense of empowerment, the sense of hope that this gives poor people is really tangible. One of my good friends who lives in a barrio above Caracas is a man named Felix, and I often had debates with him about what would happen if President Chavez weren't around, if he were killed, as Pat Robertson has suggested the United States should do. And I worried, and I still do worry, Jeff, that if he were killed, the country would descend into civil war. But Felix said no. The process would continue with or without Chavez. That Chavez was the elected leader, that he was doing, for the most part, a very wonderful job, but that the process had moved so far that people like Felix, like the people who lived in his barrio, had experienced a sense of empowerment. They had a feeling of hope for the future. that they had never experienced before in their lives. And that was not something they'd be willing to give up without a fight, with or without Chavez. Well, what is it that has given them that kind of empowerment, that feeling of hope? First of all, you have a wide range of social programs known as missions. These are ad hoc social programs attempting to immediately provide the kinds of basic social services that are both requirements to meet Venezuelans' human rights obligations to its citizens, but also to allow people, poor people in Venezuela, to participate in the democratic process in a meaningful way. Things like free health care, things which we don't have in the United States, are now widely available to all Venezuelans. Free education at every level, so much so that you now have over 40% of Venezuelans enrolled in some kind of education or another. There have been an unbelievably successful campaign to eradicate illiteracy. On October 28th of last year, 2005, the Venezuelan government announced that there was zero illiteracy in Venezuela. Now, quite a change from when Chavez was elected in 1998, when over 10% of adult Venezuelans could not read or write. A huge improvement in just a very short time period. And again, if you look at the statistics in terms of previous government's efforts to eradicate illiteracy, they don't even begin to compare with the successes of these social programs under the Chavez administration. Same thing with the healthcare program known as Misión Barrio Dentro. Ad hoc healthcare program that brings doctors to poor people to live in the poor communities, to form part of the social fabric, so that poor single mothers living in shanties above Caracas don't need to take a two-hour bus ride, spending their full 2 hours a day of income, perhaps, to get to a public hospital where they may have to wait in line for 3 days to be seen, leaving their other children at home alone. Now they can walk down the street, knock on their neighbor's door, and get quality medical attention at all hours of the day and night for free. And there's a wide range of medicines that these doctors are also given, which they can distribute for free. The increase in access to basic social services like these is really remarkable. I'll give you one last statistic on the healthcare program, which is again one of the key areas in increasing quality of life and well-being of Venezuela's poor citizens. In 2004 alone, this program, Misión Barrio Dentro, this Chavez administration health program, logged more clinical visits from Venezuelans than the entire public and private healthcare system combined over the previous 5 years. In other words, for the first time in Venezuela's history, there's some meat to the idea of free healthcare. There's some real backbone to the laws that had guaranteed Venezuelans free healthcare. Now the government is finally delivering this basic fundamental human right.
Now, I understand that there, in the book, there are like 20,000 Cuban doctors have come over there to really help build this healthcare program. Has their educational system been so successful? Has that followed the Cuban pattern as well?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are about 20,000 Cuban doctors staffing most of these clinics in the barrios, and the Cubans have also been on hand. The literacy curriculum was developed in Cuba. Many of the education campaigns and the curriculums in many of the educational missions does come out of Cuba. However, for the most part, the facilitators and the teachers in these classrooms are Venezuelans. The big issue here, and one of the main opposition criticisms of these social programs is precisely based on this issue that you've raised, Jeff, this idea that the Cubans are not actually providing social services, but are politicizing or Cubanizing Venezuela in a way that's in the interests of Fidel Castro, perhaps, but not in the interests of the Venezuelan people. This is one of the main criticisms you hear, that it's taking jobs away from Venezuelans and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the healthcare programs, all Venezuelan doctors and dentists are encouraged to sign up to work in these programs. The problem is that poor Venezuelans had an urgent, immediate need for access to healthcare, and it was a need that Venezuelan doctors were not willing to fill. So when this government decided to implement this program, they put a call out for Venezuelan doctors to staff the clinics. But very few Venezuelan doctors had gone to med school with the idea of living in a poor barrio and serving poor people for basically minimum wage. Most of them instead prefer to work on plastic surgery. Venezuela is one of the easiest countries in the world in which to get breast implants, for example. This is the kind of thing that many Venezuelans go to medical school for, not to live in poor barrios and serve underprivileged, disempowered people for free. And so the challenge was, how does the government fulfill its obligation if Venezuelans weren't willing to staff these clinics in poor neighborhoods? They found other doctors that were Cuban doctors. In the case of the educational missions, as I said, the curriculum comes out of Cuba, but the vast majority of the people in the classrooms doing the teaching, doing the facilitating of the curriculum are Venezuelans.
Now, there is also an eye care program that was even offered to Americans.
That's right. That's right. The Venezuelan government has a program in place. They had it in place. It was called Misión Milagro. It was tried out in Venezuela for several years. It was so successful. But basically, let me tell you what the mission does. It takes poor Venezuelans who have cataracts or glaucoma or other kind of relatively basic eye problems, which can be treated with relatively straightforward surgical procedures, and it flies them to Cuba for free treatment, all expenses paid. Now, they do that because there's not enough facilities in Venezuela and not enough doctors, again, to provide these surgical procedures. So they've been flying poor Venezuelans to Cuba, thousands of them now over the last several years, for these operations. And they've just begun offering the same kinds of treatment, free treatment, all expenses paid, travel to Cuba, or now I think they have some facilities in Venezuela for this as well. And the Cuban, Venezuelan government pays for transportation costs and surgery costs for poor Americans.
Well, and that leads me to, of course, an issue that became very important for some people who were freezing back east in the Bronx and in Boston, I believe coming up in Vermont, where he provided, through the Citgo company, discounted heating oil, which has upset a number of American oil people.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a really interesting factor in bilateral relations between the United States and Venezuela. Venezuela has owned, since 1992, well before Chavez was elected president, the Citgo gas station. It's a chain of gas station retailers which has now somewhere around 14,000 outlets across the United States, mainly in the East and the Northeast, but also in the Midwest, and with just under, I think about 8 refineries they own now, mainly on the Gulf Coast, but some in the heartland in Illinois as well. And through this fully owned subsidiary of the Venezuelan oil company, through Citgo, the Venezuelan government has been offering deep discounts, around 40% discounts on home heating oil to poor American families and to homeless shelters and to Native American tribes on reservations. And I think now up to 8 states, Delaware, Connecticut, mm-hmm. They've made offers to Illinois, to
Chicago turned them down, yes.
Correct. The CTA refused to accept discounted, the Chicago Transit Authority refused to accept discounted diesel fuel for their buses and trains, and then the following week raised prices, leading to widespread protests in Chicago, my hometown, actually. I think, you know, one of the interesting things is you see the Venezuelan government generously providing discounts of going to add up to about $55 million worth of discounts this year to Americans, to poor Americans. And many people say, well, why are they doing that? They've got so much poverty in Venezuela. And certainly that's true. But first of all, remember, these are pre-tax dollars. And anybody who works in big business will tell you pre-tax dollars are treated much differently than post-tax dollars. And any money that gets sent back to Venezuela has to get taxed by the U.S. government. Well, I think President Chavez would much prefer that Venezuela's oil profits be spent helping poor Americans and also highlighting a real contradiction in the American capitalist system, a contradiction really at the core of our values. Why is it that the poorest Americans, in living in the richest country in the world, cannot afford to heat their homes, even as Exxon, one of the world's largest multinational oil companies, declares world record historic profits this quarter? There's a big contradiction there.
I'm waiting for some editorial writers in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, LA Times to make the comparison.
Well, you know, of course, the great irony here, Jeff, is that the Congressional Committee on Energy has opened an investigation into the Citgo discounts.
Yes.
They're not spending their time investigating why it is that Exxon has world record profits at a time when we are struggling to pay for gas to fund our military, when we're struggling to pay for home heating oil for our homeless shelters and poorest families. They're investigating the one company that is offering to actually provide discounts to poor people in this country. It's unbelievable. Citgo has offered and indeed challenged other private gas and oil companies to join them in offering these discounts, and not a single company has been willing to take that money off their bottom line. And Citgo is the one that's under investigation. It's I think, a real testament to the failures and the corruption of our own Congress.
Amen to that. Also, I believe they're offering discounted oil and gas to other South American countries.
Correct. There's a series of complicated treaties and bilateral and multilateral treaty organizations that Venezuela has underwritten. One of them, the most sort of developed one, is called Petrocaribe. It's a treaty organization which I think now has over 15 signatories, mainly in the Caribbean Basin, Jamaica, St. Vincent, and so on. Under the terms of this treaty, those countries that are signatories have the opportunity to buy not discounted oil the way that poor Americans can buy, but actually instead of discounted oil, they pay full price, but the financing terms are very favorable. What do we mean by that? We mean they pay the full market price, but they can defer payment for several years. They can pay interest on the oil that they're deferring payment on, but it's interest that's negative real rates. In other words, the interest rates are less than inflation. In some cases, like Belize and Bolivia, these countries are invited to pay a portion of the cost of the oil they import in kind, with agricultural products, for example, rather than having to acquire U.S. dollars on the international market to make the payments. So this is one way which the Chavez administration has found to, I think, build solidarity among Latin American countries, also certainly to buy political capital in the region as it sees relations with the United States growing more and more tense. But it also is a way that the administration can experiment with alternative methods for hedging against the possibility of declining oil prices.
Now, speaking of hostility in the United States, we're about a month away from the fourth anniversary, actually, of the coup against Chavez. Now, since that time, the tension between the U.S. and Venezuela has existed, and there are many people who talk about a U.S. invasion, of course, given the situation of the U.S. in Iraq at the moment. It doesn't seem very likely, but how do you see the future of Venezuela and U.S. relations at this point in time?
Well, you know, I think that the bilateral relations have certainly gotten worse and worse during the Bush administration and the Chavez administration over the last 6 or 7 years. The rhetoric from both sides is really undiplomatic, often offensive, and counterproductive from both sides. This is true. We in our book, The Venezuelan Revolution, that we're talking about, we have one question that looks at the rhetoric, and we have a collection of quotes from both sides. Just to highlight the kinds of things that people say, I'll give you an example. In the beginning of February, Donald Rumsfeld compared President Chavez with Hitler, noting that they had both been democratically elected, as though this somehow distinguished them from other world leaders.
From Bush, for example.
For example. Exactly. Condoleezza Rice in February spoke of the need to inoculate the region against the Chavez threat. This kind of rhetoric, and then Chavez responds with really undiplomatic rhetoric of his own, is counterproductive. But if you look at the core issues, Venezuela and the United States continue to have a deep interdependence. The United States imports about 12% of our daily oil from Venezuela. Venezuela sells over 60% of its oil to the United States, and it's really locked in to a certain degree to the U.S. market because of the Citgo outlets and refineries, which process Venezuela's particularly heavy blends of crude oil. So I think we do have the need to continue finding ways to build productive relations. The problem is that the Bush administration seems absolutely unwilling to engage productively with the Chavez administration. President Chavez has never been formally received by a sitting U.S. president. It's kind of amazing to see that the Bush administration is willing to meet with people who actively participated in and supported the coup against Chavez, like Maria Corina Machado, who received hundreds of thousands of dollars a year of U.S. funding through the National Endowment for Democracy. Who knows what she receives through the CIA. And when she comes to this country, she's hailed as a leader of civil society, given a private meeting with President Bush and Condoleezza Rice on the same visit. And meanwhile, the Venezuelan ambassador to the United States can't get a meeting with these same
I want to follow up on the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, and the role of the USAID and the AFL-CIO in working with Venezuelan unions. Maybe you could elaborate on that, because this is a very important point. But if you could talk about the role of those organizations, the National Endowment, USAID, and AFL-CIO.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we do have an entire chapter of our book, The Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers, looking at the coup against President Chavez. But really, there have been three major attempts to drive him from office. The coup in April of 2002 was one of those attempts. The second attempt was a 62-day-long strike, which shut down the entire country, a strike which was centered around the oil industry. And then the third attempt was the recall referendum in August of 2004, which this woman who I mentioned, Maria Corina Machado, was one of the leaders of. And she is just one of many people in the Venezuelan opposition who receive what adds up to millions of dollars a year of funding from the U.S. government. And that's just the funding that's officially declared through files that have been released to an American lawyer named Eva Golinger, who filed the Freedom of Information Act request. There's lots of online resources I'll direct your listeners to if they want to follow up on this, of course. Our book does have the references and much of this information as well. If people want to just jump online, though, they can Google Freedom of Information Act Venezuela, put in Eva Golinger's name, and you'll come up with a website that Eva Golinger has set up, in which she actually has scanned in and put online many of the CIA files detailing the knowledge they had of the coup, of the plans for the coup the week before it happened, detailing the kinds of contracts that the National Endowment for Democracy, that the U.S. Agency for International Development, all funded with our tax dollars, the kinds of contracts these citizen-funded, congressionally-funded organizations have with private corporations in Venezuela, which in turn redistribute that money to, quote-unquote, civil society groups, like Sumate, the group that Machado founded after her participation in the coup. After her signing of the declaration that the man who named himself president, while Chavez, the democratically elected president, was being held prisoner, put in place. So, you know, we see the United States supporting elements of the Venezuelan political process which cannot really be called democratic, and calling them democratic, calling them leaders of civil society. As I said, millions of dollars is the official number. Eva Golinger has these documents on her website. There's also another website, a great source for up-to-date news on Venezuela. It's in English. All the news is in English on this site, and the website is VenezuelaAnalysis.com. If listeners go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com, they can find a wide range of news articles on these issues. But there's one article that I particularly recommend, which is written by a former CIA agent who the older of you out there will remember, a man named Philip Agee, who wrote a book in the 1970s after becoming disillusioned with his work as a CIA agent in Latin America, a book called Inside the Company. Well, Agee has recently done a report for the Venezuelan government, which is now available in English on the internet, looking at U.S. intervention, looking at exactly how the mechanisms of intervention work, the channels of funding, and so on and so forth. If you go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com and type in Agee, A-G-E-E, you can pull up a very long, detailed article explaining the ins and outs of U.S. intervention. In the article, Agee makes the argument that the model of U.S. intervention in Venezuela right now is a model based not on the coup in Chile or the coup in Guatemala, which the CIA supported, but rather the intervention against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the 1980s. In other words, it's primarily a political electoral intervention in which millions of dollars are funneled to opposition groups in Venezuela to destabilize the elected regime of President Chavez. Simultaneously in Nicaragua, you have the low-intensity paramilitary war carried out by the Contra forces, which were funded by the U.S. government through a series of illegal deals with Iran, the Iran-Contra scandal, many of us will remember. Well, in Venezuela to this day, we do not have, to date, we do not have a paramilitary proxy invasion by a Contra-like force. Well, it's one of the reasons that people in Venezuela, some people, are particularly worried about the presence of the U.S. military in Colombia, the ongoing support, billions of dollars over the last 6 years, almost $1 billion a year since 2000, of high-tech military support for the Colombian government, much of which ends up in the hands of paramilitaries operating in Colombia and with near impunity on the territory right up next to the Venezuelan border. You know, the media coverage of Venezuela is really abysmal in the United States, and there's a series of reasons for that. Look at Fox News' coverage. Look really at any of the major news outlets and their coverage of Venezuela, and you get the impression that President Chavez is a military demagogue who took power and immediately began consolidating control of the government, suppressing freedom of speech, harassing opposition political parties, running the economy into the ground. That's the impression you're given by the U.S. media. If you go to Venezuela, if you talk to most of Venezuela's poorest citizens, you get, on the other hand, the impression of a democratically elected leader who, once in office, immediately began empowering poor people, harnessing the substantial oil wealth of the country to provide for basic social services for Venezuela's 80% poor. It's a very big difference in the impression you get. And one of the reasons that the U.S. media gives us the impression they do, I think the most obvious and simple reason is that the people they get their information from when they go down to Venezuela speak English for the most part. They're the Venezuelan elite who have the opportunity to learn English, to study in American schools and universities, or they're the Venezuelan media outlets themselves, which are all corporate-owned by these same elite, which are very hostile to the Chavez administration's efforts to redistribute wealth, to empower poor people. So I think, you know, if you want to read what's really happening in Venezuela, you have to go to Venezuelan news sources that are not corporate owned. There's a lot of these out there. Venezuela Analysis, a website which I mentioned, provides English language news from a much different perspective than you'll ever get from the U.S. corporate media. I think that there's no question that foreigners, that Americans, that people of conscience who are interested in what's happening in Venezuela, who want to lend a hand, are welcome. The Venezuelan people, culturally, are very deeply connected to the United States. There's a very close cultural connection. Venezuela's most popular sport, for example, is baseball. So I think you'll find a very warm reception in Venezuela for most people. The hostility really exists between the Venezuelan government and the United States government, not at all between the Venezuelan people and the American people. I think anybody who has skills, who has a life experience, who has the kinds of technical or professional credentials, can play a valuable role in making a contribution, helping Venezuela develop a new participatory democratic process. At the end of the day, you know, most of the professional class and in the upper middle class in Venezuela do not support the Chavez administration. And this is both one of the major failings of the Chavez administration, but it's also a fact that highlights the need for I think, foreign support and for foreign expertise, kind of the opposite of the brain drain. You know, for so many decades, educated, trained Venezuelans have gone to other countries to find work where they get paid more. That process has accelerated under the Chavez administration as upper middle class citizens find that they can earn much more money overseas. And so I think if you are willing to go down there and to work in solidarity with the Venezuelan people in their political process, I think you'll find a very warm welcome. It's true that there was talk of Venezuela selling off its U.S.-based investments. Venezuela has invested more than $12 billion in the United States, providing over 150,000 jobs to American citizens, even as Venezuela continues to have above 10% unemployment. So there was talk for that reason of, and also because President Chavez was very outspoken in his criticism of the war in Iraq, and he was dissatisfied with the fact that Venezuela's U.S.-based investments were paying taxes to the Bush administration, which supported the war in Iraq. So for those reasons, there was talk about a year ago of Venezuela selling off some of its U.S.-based holdings. But for the most part, I think it was idle talk. Two refineries in particular may well be sold in the next year or so, because they're refineries that traditionally do not process Venezuelan oil. They process oil that Citgo buys from third parties. In other words, they're just part of a downstream integrated oil companies that are unrelated to Venezuela's oil. In general, however, I think opportunities like the Citgo discounted heating oil, political opportunities like that, and also the kind of guaranteed access that Citgo provides Venezuela, the guaranteed market outlet in the United States that it provides, is worth much more than it would be to sell off the companies and the holdings.
The book is The Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers, published by Thunder's Mouth Press in New York. Where else could they get the book?
The book's available online. If people type my name, C-H-E-S-A, last name B-O-U-D-I-N, into Amazon or any other online bookseller, it's widely available.
Well, of course, I recommend our local booksellers, and they should carry the book. This is an amazing book about an amazing story. And Chesa Boudin, we're going to come back to you again because this has been a very enlightening morning. I want to thank you again for being our guest and continue doing the great work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me, and look forward to talking with your listeners next time.